The Senate will come to order. We're doing a good job, only we need more bills. So we're going to have a profile report by Senator Nicholas of the Appropriation Committee and kind of for information and help us understand it all. Senator Nicholas.
Did we get the sheets handed out?
There have been a white sheet passed.
You should have a white sheet, everybody, with my name on it. The front pages are the a reproduction of the goldenrod. And the purpose today is to take you through the goldenrod for the first time, show you some of the intricacies of the goldenrod so you better understand how to read what you see when you see the goldenrod, and to give you a little idea of the budget process, where we're going. We've had some callback hearings, and we've got some things that we're learning that are going to give us less money to spend, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But let's start with the handout on page one. Now, this is just a reproduction of the goldenrod, and this is the first page. As you go through, you see your funds available, and you got your $3.9 billion, and then your expenditures. As you're going through the expenditure items, you'll see the governor's recs are in the far right-hand corner. Now, what's going to happen is that you're seeing now the October Craig status, the January Craig status, just to see what the change in the forecast is. As you recall, if you combine the school foundation program account with the general fund budget reserve account balances, between October and January, lost revenues were about $1.6 billion. And it's significant. I mean, people talk about going from $900 million to $400 million, but and I think I said that it's not $1.6 billion, but we went from about $1.6 billion down to our present level. So the impacts to the school foundation account are significant, and we'll be talking about that. On that first page, then, the $171 million is the 2009 general fund appropriations. You can see the governor's recs. I meant to say, go on to say that as we begin to pass bills out, as you hit general file on a bill, the bill will then be profiled under either the House or the Senate, whichever House passed it. So as you see the golden rods in a couple days, the governor's recs will move over to the far left. We'll drop off the October Craig and January Craig status because they're not of great importance at that time. And then there will be a column for the House position and the Senate position. But at this point, there is no JAC bill. Actually, there will be a JAC rec position, then a House, and then a Senate position. Where you see the $108 million, and I said that includes the sweep, what we're talking about is you recall that, or you may or may not recall, that in the present bill, we sweep the account that's in the budget reserve and the general fund. We sweep it down to the statutory reserve. So if the statutory reserve, that's the 5% savings that we have just as a cushion for passing checks, making sure we have sufficient funds to cover everything, is $104 million. We sweep down to zero, and that's why you see the zeros. So the $108 million, now not all of that, but the lion's share of that then flows down into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. And so the $108 million sweeps down, and I'll show you later. It's not the entire 108. I'll show you what percentage drops into there. When you look down at the LSR balance, since we've swept everything into the LSRA, which is our rainy day account, you can now pretty much profile what your surplus is available. And where I say in the bottom, new fund sweep, you see the $268 million. That, in effect, is the surplus above and beyond the present budget bill, that was available for expenditure before you came in without having to go into the LSRA. Now, a note of caution that 268 is part of the carryover. So the actual carryover you see in the first column, which is the October Craig status, and that's the $516 million. Now the reason I say the actual amount is in the October Craig status is because the $516 million is the carryover from the last fiscal year. That's the amount that was collected in excess of what we budgeted and spent. So the difference between the $516 million on that line and the $268 million is about $240 million, is my recollection. That is the amount that was required from last year's one-time carryover to fund the budget that we had outlined or that we adopted last year. Said another way, if we had not had a carryover surplus from last year, we'd be looking to cut our budget by $240 million. Because of the one-time carryover, we not only picked up that deficit, but we picked up $268 million. Point of caution, as we go through, all of these numbers are dependent upon the last estimate that the Craig Group put out. Substantial portion of those revenues are generated from minerals, as you all know, and within the mineral dollars, 60% of that is natural gas. And it doesn't take a very big swing to make changes. Having said that, one of the things, we're a little bit insulated for about a year because your assessed valuations are sort of a year behind and collections are paid a year later, so there's about a one-year insulation period. But if you were to talk to our budget staff right now, they'd say they're very nervous that we'll be able to sustain throughout this year the present Craig estimates. And we hope we will, but if we don't, you could see huge swings. When you start talking about what is the appropriate amount to put into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account, the $353 million that we have now, I generally use by reference, you go back into the early 80s when we had rainy day accounts there. At that time, our predecessors put into the rainy day accounts and into the various coffee cans about $1 billion. That $1 billion at that time was equivalent to the general fund budget reserve at the time, which is about $1 billion. Our general fund budget reserve now is three times that amount. For those of us that were here in the late 90s, we know that we expended through that $1 billion. We finally did hit the last coffee can in about the time I came in, when Senator Larson and others were, then we were all commissioned to have revenue expenditure studies to pick up a $500 million deficit that year. My point there is that if you think in terms of the last legislature putting away $1 billion for $1 billion general fund, if you wanted to have the same cushion, it would require $3 billion today. We're a long way from there, and as we go forward, you know, I submit to you that even when you have a more modest surplus than you thought, there's always a need to put more money into your rainy day account, because that's what you do, is you save some component. And $350 million, that's a sneeze compared to what you can lose when you begin to look at the impact of natural gas prices on our budget. School Foundation Program Balance Account, the $100 million. The reason why that amount is $100 million is because of another sweep. So the first sweep that we just talked about takes the general fund budget reserve and sweeps it down to our statutory reserve and puts all the excess into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. Part of the reason we did that was to get people thinking in terms of savings and think in terms of when you have these one-time carryover surpluses, You put them into savings, and your choice is between saving and spending. We have a very generous budget out there, and you always make that choice. Within the school foundation program account, we'll see the profile on that in a minute, but a substantial amount of the foundation program account is funded by federal mineral royalties, because when we de-earmarked, took the earmarking away from local communities, we left the earmarking for the school foundation program account. And because of that, we were receiving revenues that were in excess of what they needed to operate. Senator Coe pointed that out in a spreadsheet that similar to what we had some time ago. We took some of those excess monies off to fund the Hathaway program and the higher education endowment programs. What we've done in the present bill is we said we're going to each year take it down to $100 million. And the surplus will go into the Common School Permanent Land Fund. Because if you look at the size of that fund, it's similar to the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, but it's a permanent fund funding schools. If you look at that, it's grossly inadequate to start picking up any significant obligations of schools. And it seems to, and we sort of agreed last year that it's time to begin looking at beefing that account up. We've never been able, we have transferred a little bit of money into the permanent fund, but we're going to have a difficult time doing it for reasons I'll explain later. The water development counts 1, 2, and 3, those combined balances are on that sheet. Now, when you turn over to page 2 of the document, that is the general fund profile. So you have the balances above, the appropriations before below, and you could see where I blocked out the governor's recs for $171 million of spending. I'll show you a sheet with the governor's recs, but to get his number down to that level for the things that he recommended spending, he recommended that we spend, for example, $37 million that we set aside into savings to deal with the Capitol complex, to deal with the renovations to this building, which will be significant. It was a charge led by Senator Mockler and others to begin developing the reserve to go forward. Governor says, I'd rather spend that than save it for that, recommends that. So his actual spending requests are up in the $200 million range and actually would exceed the amount of our present surplus by dipping into these coffee cans. And that's one of the things that we've got to decide is whether we're going to just agree with that position. My first inclination is not. We save those monies for a purpose. Purpose remains. It's not gloom and doom now. We still have a great budget. We intended to save for the renovation of this building. It will be expensive, and it's necessary. And as Senator Mockler pointed out, that you have one of the most precious buildings in the state that has no sprinkler system, no protection, and it's an asset of the state that needs saving. So you'll get to choose, do you want to spend that on highways, or do you just want to hold your budgets? When you begin to see the bills passed on general file in either the House or the Senate, that they're funded out of the general fund, they will begin to be profiled on this page underneath the governor's recs off on another column that will be added. Going to the next page, page 3, now we get into the budget reserve account. And a couple things I want to point out to you there. You've got your revenues in, and then you've got your appropriations, and then I put the LSRA current sweep. So those are the dollars that sweep into the LSRA. So had the governor not recommended spending anything, we would have added to the LSRA the $268 million. The governor's because of the governor's rec, there's only $45 million being transferred in. The governor's recs are developed after he talks to members of appropriations and principally the chairman and I assume leadership. And I had talked early on with the governor of setting a target of putting at least $50 million of our present reserves or our present carryover into the LSRA reserve. He hit $45 million and said, if you want to hit $50, it's up to you to figure out where to take it from. The governor has recommended out of the budget reserve that we transfer $11 million to Water Count 1. That's principally the Gillette project, or it's not principally, it is the Gillette project. And then he cataloged in $39 million for property tax relief. So you've got two big components in his recommended expenditures that will have a great impact on our budget. One is the $39 million for tax relief that he targeted, and then you've got $50 million for highways. Combined, they're $89 million. I submit to you at the end of the day that those are going to be the budget balancers. Those are everything you spend. Everything you do gets measured against those two projects, including savings. So if you want to save, if you want to do some of the other things, if you want to preserve the $37 million, those are the areas where those monies would come out of. Then when you drop down, you see in the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account where the sweeps came in. We've already talked about those numbers. When you see that $402 million for the 09-010, what in essence happened, those were forecasted revenues in October. There are no forecasted surpluses under the January Craig estimates. That takes you over to page 4. Now we start talking about the foundation program account. Later I'll show you the profile where the money comes to get into the school foundation program account because it's important to understand. When you look at the school foundation program account and the income coming into that account, I pointed out in that line that says transfers in from school CapCon account, the $25 million, that's a repayment because we have a provision that with the when we put foundation program account monies into the school CapCon account to cover the cost of constructing schools, if COLE's bonuses come into the account and exceed what we need to meet our budget, then the CapCon account repays that money back to the school foundation account. It's a pretty nominal amount compared to the amount that's being utilized. Now, school capital construction is one of the biggest monkeys out there that we have to deal with. Our present effort is to fund about $400 million of school capital construction per year around the state. That's a new obligation the state picked up when we did school refinance. It's a huge obligation, and we have no permanent steady source of revenues to pay for it. So we've been fortunate that the school foundation program account not only covers the cost to related to operating our schools, the operating costs, but we've been able to pay the cost, a major cost component of schools. If we lose that revenue source and go back to where we were in the 90s, where we were having to use general fund money to pay for either the operating costs for schools or the school capital construction account, that changes our profile in ways significant. So big swings can happen here. Down in the appropriations, you see the program cost, the mandatory is about $1.1 billion. You go down to about education reform, and you'll end up with about $1.2 or $1.3 billion. The $1.3 billion is probably the minimum amount you'd ever have to fund, and or that you would have to fund. So the balance are things that you might say, well, we have some option to pay. The $1.3 billion is what you have to come up with year in and year, biennium in, biennium out. Now, when you look at the square, the school cap, there's two lines there. Above the square is the transfer to the Common School Permanent Land Fund, $245 million. That's the projected sweep that would occur into the Common School Permanent Land Fund under our present budget. The Appropriations Committee has a bill that it's putting out to recommend a change to the budget. The change that's being recommended is that instead of sweeping that directly into the Common School Permanent Land Fund, that we first sweep that money into the school capital construction account. And then the present bill would say that We will then sweep from the school capital construction account into the common school permanent land fund after the end of the biennium, but retaining at least one half of the amount that was spent in the prior biennium for schools. So if you spent $400 million on school capital construction, you would hold the reserve there at $200 million to make sure that we have adequate reserves to go forward in the next biennium. So it would, if that were to happen today, the sweep instead of being $245 million would be more like $45 million. But what it does is give us one more level of protection that we can absorb any broad swings in our revenues. Underneath the Common School Permanent Land Fund sweep, you see the school CapCon transfer. So what's happening now, to meet our school obligations, you're transferring $251 million from the school foundation program account into the school capital construction account. So I've just arrowed that down to show you where those monies are going and give you a feel for the need for those dollars. Remember, with co-lease bonuses, we do not profile co-lease bonuses until the sales are made and confirmed. So that while there may be co-leases scheduled that have not taken place, you can't count on them, you can't profile them until the sales are actually completed and the sales confirmed by the MMS folks, and we begin receiving money. So these budgets, we always hope that we'll pick up more money, which will relieve the school foundation program obligation to fund that. You switch to the next page. These are the two accounts that are part of the spending policy reserve. You recall that we, for the Permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund, the Common School Permanent Land Fund, and also with the New Hathaway accounts, we authorized the first 5% of the revenues to be spent and be deposited into the general fund. Amounts above that go into the Common School Permanent Land or the Spending Policy Reserve account. And if you have revenues well above that, they tip over and go into the corpus of the permanent land or the permanent funds, whichever the appropriate fund. Just a note there, you'll recall it's only a year ago that the Treasurer's Office was advising that there were a great deal or a couple hundred million dollars of capital gains that had not been realized, and saying, look, if you want to spend more money, you could intercept those gains before we could convert the gains into cash, then you could take the money and you could spend it as opposed to putting it into the policy, which would convert it and roll it into the permanent fund. The point that we see here with a lower valuation is the importance of adhering to your long-term policies. The Senate rejected the idea last year that we would do that. Turned out to be a good decision, and it's a good time to reflect. And as you go forward, to remember these spending policies are meant for years and years. And this is a classic example why we try to both inflation-proof and grow our corpus in light of the fact that we've authorized the Treasurer to invest in equities. The next page is page 6 of the document. Those are the balances before and after the Gov's recs into the three water accounts. Turning into then, we turn off of the, we now leave the goldenrod and go to a profile sheet, which is just a general fund budget reserve account profile sheet for the 11-12 biennium. And what it shows is that if we sustain our the January Craig estimates, and if we don't increase our spending, we look pretty good in the next biennium. We can probably sustain about the same level of spending that we have now. But when you begin to digest that, The flip side of that is as you increase your operating dollars, so for every dollars, if we come out of here with $40 million, $50 million of operating dollars, that translates to $100 million for a biennium, and it comes off of the balance available. So you're essentially eating into that balance available. And what that means, or you look at the one-time projects, the dollars for cities, towns, and counties, the dollars for community colleges, UW, those are the balances, that discretionary dollars, capital construction around the state, that's where you begin to erode in. So as you grow your operating budget now, what you erode into is the ability to do the one-time spending that we're doing in this biennium, which is, I submit to you that when you talk to your constituents, that's what they see out of the budget. They don't see the Department of Health. They don't see, some people do, but when they start to see changes of the state, it's those one-time dollars that are going into infrastructure, and you limit your ability as you increase your size of your operating dollars. You turn to the next page, and that is the includes the 11-12 profile with the school capital construction account. And that's where you see a $344 million deficit if nothing happens. But a couple things are going to happen in all likely. First of all, we have the school foundation program sweep that was presently scheduled to go into the Common School Permanent Land Fund with the bill moving through that the JAC has sponsored. Those dollars will first go into the school capital construction account, and that some of those dollars would be available before. And then in addition, it's not unreasonable to anticipate under, if things go reasonably okay, that we'll see as much as $100 million of coal lease bonuses. Hopefully more, but the staff thinks that $100 million is not an amount that we would not see. So, again, you look at it, it doesn't look all that bad. Having said that, it depends on sustaining and maintaining the January Craig estimates. The next page, page 9, I put into, it's the School Foundation Program Account revenues. So these are the annual revenues in, and the purpose is a couple things to show to you, and that is to understand where your school foundation program monies come from. The property taxes, you can see, is anticipated or projected in the 11-12 biennium to be $543 million. That's down from the $596 million that we see now. That some property taxes are, you know, they come out in October. They're about a year behind, so you're getting taxed next year on this year's value. But if we begin to see declines in the assessed valuations around the state, we could see those numbers suffer beyond what we're anticipating right now. I mean, they've projected some reductions, but not a lot. The big item, if you look at that account, is the federal mineral royalties. So those are the dollars that are explained that are earmarked coming from FMRs to this account, $628 million in the next biennium. That's the largest source of dollars to this account, and 60% of those monies are generated generally from natural gas and those prices. If you want to reconcile those numbers to the goldenrod, that's what I've done, where I've said the carryover of $338 million. You add in the CAFCON repayment, and you come up with about $2.1 billion that you'll see on the goldenrod. If we were to complete that sweep, $240 million in the 11-12 biennium, then you won't see $2.1 billion. You'll see something considerably less than that. The next sheet is the governor's recs. So these are the reconciled governor's recs, and you can begin to see now the governor in December recommended about $440 million when our one-time carryover was about $500 million. He's reduced in January his recs to about $213 million. with a $226 million reduction. But those, that $213 million, he spends $37 million of the capital complex reserve account that we've set aside. You can see over on the right for some of the facilities with the Department of Health, he's recommending that we switch funding sources to the omnibus land funds that were created to maintain some of the Department of Health facilities. And he recommends that we pay take some of our spending and apply it towards the tobacco account. So in most instances, in the Scott bill that's coming through for the some of the health care initiatives, the governor said, I support that, but since we don't have general fund dollars left, let's go to the tobacco account. Here's a caveat. We're now engaged in callbacks. We had Department of Health yesterday. The governor's estimates assume that the department is going to live with the Medicaid dollars that are available. The department came in yesterday and said that the trends between the time that they predict they have now, they're trending between the time of the that we met in December and today, and these trend numbers they advised were developed after the governor made his recs, show that the Medicaid program right now is underfunded by $33 million. In our budget, we have a $20 million reserve set up with the Department of Audit available and set aside for the purposes of picking up some of those shortfalls. But even if you were to attach all of those, it would still be a $13 million deficit that the governor's not accounted for in his budget. In addition, the governor did not recommend shortening any of the waiting lists for the developmentally disabled, and those under the adult waivers and child waiver programs. If we were wanting to eliminate those back to even a one-year waiting list, that would require $8 million. And the governor has not accounted for some statutory changes. I mean, he's accounted for that. But if I go back and do just a short analysis of $33 million shortfall, $8 million for the statutory payments that for the additional substance abuse regional treatment beds in CASPER that CASPER is expecting that we'll fund. If you look at the external cost adjustments for the DD preschools that are in statutes and the funding for new children, that's in excess of $4 million. So all of those dollars, all you do is take the shortfall, you were to take care of waiting list, and you would take care of the adult waivers, you'd have $49 million of new spending in the Department of Health. And if you begin to look at a lot of the bills that we have, there's an excess of $400 million of appropriations and bills that are moving through. Many of those are targeted towards the Department of Health. And before you even begin to look at those new programs, where we're going, you got $49 million that of really very important things that we're probably not going to fully fund. So as you begin to look at these early bills that come out of the Appropriations Committee, you get a better sense of what we're working against. We take your bills that come through, and we compare them, and we have already tallied up all the bills with appropriations for the Department of Health. We've looked at them. And so as you bring your bills in, it's not as though that's the first time we looked at the amounts. We've had Department of Health people go through the bills, prioritize them against these, and we have those in our mind. And but so I guess it's sort of fair warning that when you come in, this is what we're working against. We're trying to create a reasonable amount of money available for everybody, but recognizing that we have some pretty heavy responsibilities out there with bills that have already been passed. The next sheet is the, that takes us over to, I'm flipping pages. The next one is just a flow chart. I'm not sure if it's going to help you, but we've gotten pretty intricate about what goes into the account, what sweeps out to the Common School Permanent Land Fund. We had them diagram it if you want to sit up at night and look at that and try not to have a headache, have at it. But that begins to show the complexity of what we're doing. So that's just a general overview of what we're looking at. It's sort of an attempt to give you a little bit of warning in advance of what to expect for appropriations scrutiny of your bills. And it's an effort to, when we come out, to educate you so that as we come out and say, look, this item just didn't deserve the priority of things that are already in the budget, we would hope that you would remember some of these things. And there are some rudders you have to develop yourself, and one of the rudders is do you want to have surplus added to the common school or to the rainy day account? And I guess my target was about $50 million. It seems to me that it's not unreasonable when you have a surplus to put something in your savings account. Do you want to preserve the $37 million that was set aside for this building? And are you prepared to do that, or would you rather build highways or something else? It seems to me that this building has always been sort of the last consideration. The governor says, hey, it's your building. You worry about it. I'm not going to put in our budget. We have worried about it. We've set aside money. How easily are you prepared to give those monies up? So those are rudders that you need to do. And if you decide that to agree with those appropriate rudders, and I don't know what the committee is going to do, I hope they try to preserve those monies, then you're going to have to give up in other places in the governor's recs. And that's before we even get to our own bills. Mr. President, that stand for questions or sit for questions?
Thank you very much. A very good report. And I think perhaps we should try to limit our questions to understanding the report and probably not get into the bills and the dollars at this point. You know, Senator Bebout.
Mr. President, and the question I have deals with the carryovers. And I want to be sure that when we look at, we had the $400 million that came into the budget, it's on page one. When we started October, we went to January, then went to zero, and then we had the 07-08 of 268. And when we look at the 11-12 biennium, I'm just cautious about, do we really have the carryover of $105 million out of the numbers there that we're seeing representative of where we are 2 years out? That's my concern, Mr. President, to see what we're looking at. I think I really understand where we are in the current budget cycle with the carryovers and the loss of revenues that we didn't go. But when we go into 11-12, that $105 million, I want to be sure that that's a good number.
Eli, are you looking at the 104,880 and rounding that to 105? Is that the 105 that you're talking about?
Mr. President, yeah, I'm looking on your cheat sheet number 7 where you show 105 as a carryover from the previous biennium, that when we look at the numbers on the goldenrod, we have a 268 surplus with January Craig, but we could spend all of that. And how do you come up with 105 for the 11-12 carryover? For the 11-12 budget.
Senator Nicholas.
Yeah.
I believe it'd be line 3 on page 7.
Carryover that you're bringing over. Is that right there? It's the statutory reserve account. That's the carryover you're bringing up.
I think that is the statutory reserve, and that's the suite. Yeah. Okay, Eli, or Senator Bebout, when you're looking at what's happening on that sheet, the $104 million, which is the carryover, that represents the statutory reserve. So if you turn over to page 1, you begin to look at the 104, 880. That is your statutory reserve. So long as two things happen, one is our revenues sustain based upon the January estimate, and and we don't spend into the statutory reserve, we will have that as a carryover. In fact, what ends up, the first thing that happens is we lower the sweep. So if you look at the sweep above that comes out of the $108 million, on that under $108 million, if you want to see how much is swept into the rainy day account, you would look over at page 3, yeah. I had it highlighted here. I'll find it for you here. Okay, you. Water fund. The sweep. So, looking over to the budget reserve account line, you see that the $45 million is swept over to the LSRA. And so that $45 million, if you were to see a decline, the amount that gets underfunded is the sweep. So which makes your statutory reserve fairly secure. So you drop money, you lose your sweeps first, so that if things go differently, the first impact you see is to the rainy day account, assuming that we still have sweeps. If you were to decide to make no savings into the LSRA, then you could see the those changes. Now, with respect to the $402 million that you first referenced, that's gone. That was the increase in the October Craig over the January estimates of last year. And then what ended up happening is they lowered the estimates to lower than the January estimates of last year, which then that's why we lost the $402 million, and then about $240 million was required to fund our present budget. All of that is dependent, though, on everything changes if our gas prices drop.
Senator Bebout.
I think you answered my question. The concern I had was that we weren't getting some carryovers that we thought that may or may not be there, and that was that $104.9 million that we showed for 11-12, and it's that other account. And that was my concern, and that's you're exactly right, and I understand it.
Well, I would add to that, Mr. President, the reason why I identified the sweeps throughout here is so the folks will see that what we have done with respect to surpluses, trying to sweep them into savings accounts, sometimes permanent savings, and we'll be making a policy decision as to whether to back off some of those sweeps in light of our present situation, but still keeping some a long-term plan to make sure that we try to add to the corpus of our common school land fund. But that's why the sweeps are important to understand and to be able to identify if you're trying to analyze this.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. I had a question for the good senator from Laramie, and this has to do with the Hathaway program. On page 4, right down there where it says one-half transferred that you have written in there,
yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Thanks.
A couple of questions I have, and I guess one of them is, where are we at on that account now as far as the total account in the Hathaway program, as far as, you know, like reaching the total amount that we had actually, I think it was like $400 million or something we were reaching for somewhere in there? That was one of the questions. And the other one was, are we still spending the extra corpus that we put in there before to take care of the program for the current students, or are we now spending the interest and dividends on that? And then the last one is, do we have enough going in there, even though we're short on revenues, so to speak, at this time? Do we have enough in there to sustain the number of students that are using the program? And how do we set,
Mr. President, thank you, Mr. President. The information I'm going to give you now, I think, is accurate. And in addition, we are having a call back, both the university and the treasurer's office, later this week to investigate and to make sure we understand that in detail. But generally speaking, the facts are the original dollars that we appropriated and to set up both the higher education endowment account as well as the Hathaway account have been completed and the original goals have been achieved. They've been funded. However, last year we began to, the group that was overlooking the Hathaway, sort of supervising it, determined that at the present level of a commitment that we would be short in the Hathaway account if we didn't supply some more money. So we appropriated $50 million of coal lease bonuses to supplement the original appropriation to the Hathaway account. Of that $50 million, one half, $25 million, has been collected and transferred to the Hathaway account. The second half of that does not transfer until next summer. Generally speaking, we believe, and then I'm going to talk about in a second, the shortfall for funding the present obligations. But it's our belief that the Hathaway account, the endowment account, will require that entire $50 million to be fully funded so that while some people have pointed to that as a source of dollars to maybe to take care of immediate shortfalls, the wisdom would be better to leave those dollars there. Let me say that, right, just stop there for a minute, take a breath. Our general position and that we would like to take as the JAC, or at least that as I've tried to encourage people to take, is one of transparency and owning up to your present obligations. So, for example, there's $170 million in this account, $150 million right below that, being transferred or above that out of the foundation account into the school retirement account or to the general retirement account, what we call the big fund, to cover an obligation that's owed, is developed for, because we underfunded the retirement obligations of teachers. And the notion there is that we've already created that obligation and our first obligation is to pay for what we already agreed that we would do. The same is true with the Hathaway. Instead, your choices are to say, well, we'll worry about these later, or we'll say we've made the obligation now, let's fund it, and let's own up to what we've spent, and that's the first priority of spending. In this case, what we are learning is that the treasurer has come back to all accounts and lowered their expectations for interest off or collections off of both the Hathaway account. This would be true for the Permanent Mental Trust Fund and as well as the Higher Education Endowment, and there is a shortfall. And I want to say the shortfall is going to be between the two accounts about $7 million. And it needs to be attended to. It's not in the governor's rec. It's something we'll be attending to. Those dollars generally, though, come out of the school foundation program account, or we can intercept. What we've done is actually not taken them out of the account. We've intercepted some of the federal mineral royalties before they're deposited into the account to pay for that. So we have enough money to take care of that. So there's not enough revenue from the endowment accounts to pay the ongoing obligations. Now, we did, as you pointed out, we front-loaded the operational dollars. Because of the way we front-loaded it, we put it into the reserve account, and then when there was income coming in, some of that money was swept into the corpus. So, and that's just the way it is. If that money had not swept in the corpus, we might have enough money, but it did sweep in the corpus, and the operating account now is underfunded, and my recollection is it'll be about $3 million for, I think, the higher education endowment account, about $4 million for the Hathaway, and they may be different. We will have better numbers, and we'll provide you those sheets once we receive them.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, as I read these numbers and listen to the explanation,
It seems to me, first, that we're in reasonably good shape this time, that our real trouble is going to come if current mineral revenues stay the same or decline in the future. That's where we're going to have trouble making our operating expenses. It seems to me further that a major source of our trouble on the spending side is the Medicaid program and the health care. And the nature of that program is that it is an open-ended entitlement, that you can't control it by the amount of money you appropriate for it, because they'll just spend it and come back and tell you have to appropriate more. And with the unique nature of that particular program and the way it runs from the feds, you don't really have any choice. So if you're going to control that program, you have to look ahead of time at eligibility, at services that are authorized, at the way the program is structured and the way it operates. So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, the point I want to make is that that's a slow program to turn around, that we have to do some things now in order to be prepared for what we might hit a year or 2 years from now in terms of the spending there. And I want to suggest to you that there are significant opportunities in controlling spending, taking a hard look at that program. We had a very interesting presentation to Committee 10 the other day. The average cost of the non-disabled adults in the Medicaid program is 50% more than comparable adults in a private Blue Cross Blue Shield program. The average cost of children in the Medicaid program is twice what it is in that private program. There's some real opportunities there. Some of them are there because of the way the federal government prohibits us from controlling the costs. Some of them, I think, with some creative work, we can get around some of those federal controls. But I would suggest to the Senate and to the Appropriations Committee that now is the time we need to start thinking about how we're going to take steps in the future to control the growth in that particular program, because if we wait till next year, I think we'll find it's too complicated to do in just during a legislative session or in one budget. So I would urge the Appropriations Committee, as you look at these projections, Mr. President, are a wake-up call for where we may go. Let's start looking for some of those alternatives, and some of us who've had some experience with that program stand ready to give you a hand on some of the places where the opportunities may be.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would concur with some, but cautiously waiting for some of the other comments, point out a couple things. Our biennial budget for the Department of Health with the governor's recs in it is about $1.5 billion. Of that, $990 million is the health care financing, the Medicaid component that Senator Scott refers to. And he's absolutely correct that that is a huge part of it. Having said that, mental health and substance abuse now is $235 million. That's a huge component. Developmental disabilities, $129 million. So we have other components that are quite expensive. And while we try innovations, we need to be cautious on that. And part of my concern is that while I see multiple programs that we have funded intended to do early intervention, education, things to get people improve their lives, you don't always see the savings. But I acknowledge we have to look at these things. One of the things that we heard from the Department of Health that is of interest to me, and I think everybody should take a sort of a deep breath and think about it, what's causing the trend increase? Why are we seeing a trend increase over the course of the last 2 months? I think I've listened in on at least three or four folks, including the governor, say that it doesn't seem like that Wyoming seems to be insulated from these national recessionary issues. In my own case, in our community, I can tell you we have probably 300 engineers in Laramie that depend on oil and gas development. My son works for an oil and gas company, and they just laid off, that has fields in Wyoming, they've laid off two or three managers and four or five people. We're going to see layoffs up in Campbell County, some of the coal mines. I read in the paper that unemployment is up in Albany County, and what we're seeing here, among other things, is that some of the children that were in the SCHIP program are now moving on to the Medicaid program, and that's because they have less revenue in their family. And when they move into the Medicaid program, that means they pick up all their family members. Our births are up. We have more births now, and you have to remember that 47% of all births are delivered by Medicaid. That we have higher births, and the 47% of Medicaid deliveries remains there. And so we're seeing a trend that we don't know where it's going. But I submit to you that as we're these programs are going to be utilized, and they're going to be more heavily utilized over the next year and a half because, in fact, we're not insulated. It may be that your friends are maintaining their jobs, that there are people out there that are losing revenue, that are going to have problems, and it's of concern.
Thank you very much, Senator Nicholas. Very informative. It might not have been what we all wanted to hear, but I think we needed to hear it and think about it as we move forward. Reports from standing committees.
January the 20th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 92, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. January the 20th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 82, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Larson, Martin, Perkins, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. Bill.
Senator Larson.
Mr. President, I tried to do this earlier and you wouldn't let me, but Senate File 92, which was just read in, contains a substantial change in appropriations, and I would ask that it be re-referred to the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 92 will be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, without objections. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are, Senator Coe.
Yeah, Mr. President, Senate File 89, read in out of Education earlier, has an appropriations. I would request it be re-referred to Committee Number 2, as Senate File 89.
Senate File 89 will be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, without objections. Okay. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business of considerations of bills and general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Senator Meyer. Go on to
Yes.
Committee of Whole will come to order. The first file for our consideration is Senate File 90. Would the reading clerk please read in the file?
Senate File 90, sponsored by Senator Ross, Unemployment Insurance Spouse of Deployed Military, and Act Relating to Unemployment Insurance Benefits.
Senator Hassard? Well, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 90. And to explain this bill, I'd like to call on sponsor Senator Ross.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, I bring to you today Senate File 90. It's entitled Unemployment Insurance Spouse of Deployed Military. The genesis of this bill was brought to me by the Department of United States Department of Military out of Denver, and locally here our Air Force Base, and of course we have our National Guard members on a large issue concerning deployment that may be coming up in the future. As you know, all of us that employ individuals pay into an unemployment insurance account, and you may or may not be able to access that account if you lose your job. As a general rule, if you quit your job, you were not eligible for unemployment. And there are a number of reasons why you may or may not be eligible for unemployment. Currently, our military folks are subject to transfer for their duty stations. And generally, as we all know in this day and age, It more often than not, both spouses are working to support the family. You have a military member, and then you have a civilian spouse who is employed. You receive a change of duty orders, and you are transferred. Currently, under our current law, the civilian spouse is ineligible for unemployment insurance benefits. There could also be a situation, and that's the primary people that would be seeking unemployment insurance benefits, but you could also have, in a situation in which we are deploying our military, where the civilian spouse remains at home and, for whatever reason, may not be able to make it and may need to move in with their mother or father or family members to make a go of it, and are no longer eligible to are no longer able to keep their employment going. This bill would allow unemployment insurance benefits for those civilian spouses who are subject to orders for transfer, and or if there is a deployment and the situation presents itself beyond their own control to such a degree that they're now no longer eligible or able to be employed, at least at their current job. I will tell you that the evidence and the testimony about these individuals are that they're highly motivated. and good workers. And generally, once they get a change of duty, they have, of course, may move to a different state or whatever. They are immediately trying to get new employment. Many of them are nurses or other kinds of things that have to go through new licensure requirements or temporary licensures or whatever else to try to get their employment. But the average statistics from the Department of Military are from the defense manpower data as of June of 08 indicates that as a general rule, when you're trying to calculate how many people would be eligible, and there are 19 states that already do this, have some sort of form of insurance employment benefits for the civilian spouses, that generally what you look at is you take the total number of military people in the state, you divide that in half, generally because about half of the military force is married, and then divide that amount again by 50% because about only 50% of the spouses are employed. And then statistically from those numbers, 60% will transfer, and of that percentage, only 25% ever actually file for unemployment compensation. The bill is intended to, when you go into page 2, well, basically, if you look at 27.3.311, it tells you who is disqualified from unemployment insurance benefits. And what we've added in is a new subparagraph D under Romanet I, which would allow an exception for these individuals so that they could obtain unemployment insurance benefits. So in essence, if the civilian spouse becomes unemployed as a result of relocation due to a transfer from which it is impractical to commute to a new their place of employment or current employment, that individual will be eligible for, they have certain things that they've got to do, to have uninsurance employment benefits. They still must apply, and they must do all the things that are necessary to show that they are seeking employment and so forth. The average unemployment benefit duration is approximately 12.7 weeks. I had thought, and we had thought, that the language on page 3, lines 2 through the middle of line 8, took into account those that would be deployed. I think it's somewhat vague, so I do have a committee of the whole amendment to make sure that we take into account our National Guard members and their the fact that there may be a deployment situation, and we know there's going to be a big deployment this year, that those individuals would be eligible under the right circumstances for unemployment benefits. I will tell you further that I had discussions, when you look at the fiscal note of this bill, I had discussions after committee with after the committee heard this bill with the director of Department of Employment. He and I had questioned the amount of money in the fiscal note. Now, recognize that this is not general fund dollars. It just comes from the UI fund itself. The Department of Employment's estimate was about half of what this fiscal note showed. However, in working with the Department military department, they came up with this figure, and he questions also whether or not the figure is accurate. However, having said that, the UI fund pays out in Wyoming about $54 million a year. If you accept the figures of the fiscal note, that even at that amount, we're talking about 1% of the UI fund is more than capable of handling this. And as the Director of Department of Employment indicated, it is a drop in the bucket for this this fund. So this is a way that we can assist our military, treat them fairly. As we are sending troops all over the world, it seems like these days, under the current state of the law, it seems to me that it is unfair to the civilian employee not to be eligible for unemployment. And this is a way that we can do so and help them as their lives are changed dramatically because of deployments and or transfers duty station-wise. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 be read in.
Will the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
Senate File 90, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 7.
You wish to move the amendment, Senator Ross.
I will. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 90. This is an amendment that the military department gave me to ensure that that we are covering our National Guard members. And so on page 3, line 8, after the term code, and as I indicate, I thought that that language already included our National Guard, but just to be safe, we add in the language in page 3, line 8, so that it says, or training or other duty performed by a member of the Army National Guard of the United States or the Air National Guard of the United States, and under sections, and there's a list of them entitled 32 of the United States Code, makes it clear that our National Guard members could be also eligible for unemployment benefits. And so with that, I stand for questions on the amendment and or the bill and urge your favorable consideration.
We are on the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing no discussion on the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. We are back on the bill. Senator Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering whether this provision would cover those individuals in a common law relationship.
Senator Ross.
The answer would be no. Wyoming does not recognize common law marriage, and so in that situation, there would be no UI benefits for the civilian spouse because we don't even recognize it as a lawful marriage.
Senator Esquivel, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I'm not mistaken, Colorado does, and I just wonder if Wyoming would recognize common law relationship with Colorado. And I'm not sure how that would work out with someone in the Wyoming Guard, but anyway, I was just wondering about that. Thank you.
Senator Ross.
I think you need to recognize that this bill treats current Wyoming military when they're being deployed and or transferred, not coming in to the state of Wyoming. Whether or not Colorado, you're absolutely correct, Senator, does recognize common law marriage. To what extent that occurs within the military, common law marriages, I'm not sure. But it didn't seem to be a problem. And this bill really is kind of a used Colorado law to assist in drafting this particular piece of legislation.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, kudos especially on the amendment. I'm all for our Air National Guard and National Guardsmen, and I would vote for anything that would benefit them on their deployment. I'm actually more concerned about the effect on the state and the cost of the, to our UI account on for regular members of the armed forces. So I'm trying to figure out exactly who this applies to. Does it apply to airmen at the air base if they're transferred to another air base and, let's say, the they're waiting for housing for the family, as an example. And so, and sometimes there are delays of up to months for the, for housing for the family at other Air Force bases and other places. Would it apply to them? And my other question is, does it apply to military recruiters around the state as they're transferred either around the state or out of the state?
Senator Ross.
With regard to the first question concerning our active duty United States military, i.e., most of these people would be from Francis C. Warren Air Force Base. It would depend on whether or not they are married or not. If the military person doesn't, he or she themselves do not, are not eligible for unemployment insurance benefits because they're paid directly through the Department of Defense, United States Treasury, versus a civilian spouse who's employed off base at United Medical Center or something like that, that's the person that we're talking about that would be eligible for the benefits. There are situations in which, you know, housing could become a problem in moving to another base or those kinds of things. There was testimony in committee from individuals from the Air Force base about what they do and the services that they provide to try to make sure to make those transitions as smooth as possible in working not only with within this locale but other bases around the nation and so forth. And they do quite a lot of services on behalf of those military people to try to ameliorate a lot of those problems. With regard to recruiters, they are active duty, and if in fact, let's say they were a recruiter here in Cheyenne and were transferred to Sheridan, the civilian spouse would be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits because it would be impractical for that civilian spouse to maintain their job in Cheyenne. And living so far away in Sheridan, so it would depend on whether or not, and that would is taken care of on lines 18, 19, and 20 of page 2. If unemployment as a result of relocation due to the transfer of the unemployed individual spouse either within or outside of the state from which it is impractical to commute to the place of employment.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, does the fiscal note reflect the Committee of the Whole amendment?
Senator Ross.
The answer is yes. I thought the fiscal note, and after talking with the Director of the Department of Employment, I thought that was overstated. When you look at the fiscal note under assumptions says that the Wyoming Department of Employment, in conjunction with the military department, estimate that due to the current deployment schedule, that approximately 180 military spouses may receive benefits. I think that's an overstatement because the and I think the testimony is that more than likely the deployment itself will not cause the civilian spouse to lose their job unless, for whatever reasons, as I gave an example, they simply cannot make it now that the individual's gone, their spouse is gone for a year or something and must move in with their parents or something else like that. But they would still be here in this locale and would still have their job in a deployment situation. The question may come up, though, that they may have to move or whatever. But those situations are hard to predict. Certainly, the transfer of military people is easier to predict, given the data that we have available to us and the statistics that are kept by the United States military itself.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, one last question. Other than leaving the deployment aside, assuming that the two wars in the Middle East are going to wind down over the next couple of years, other than the airmen at the Air Force Base and any recruiters around the state, who else would this affect?
Senator Ross.
Well, I'm not exactly certain, but I would submit that there are probably active duty personnel at various locations throughout the state, but primarily located here in Cheyenne. And, of course, then it would affect all of our National Guardsmen who are stationed all over the state. Certainly the bulk is here in Cheyenne, but particularly our National Guards people are scattered all over the state of Wyoming. So it primarily will affect them more realistically than our active duty people here in Cheyenne.
Any further discussion on the bill? The question has been called for. The question is on Senator Larson's motion. When the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a do pass motion on Senate File 90. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, aye. Senate File 90 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 91. Would the reading clerk please read in the file?
Senate File 91, sponsored by Senator Landon, Driver's Licensing and School Enrollment, and Act Relating to Driver's Licenses.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 91. There is a standing committee amendment, but I'd like to deal with that after the sponsor explains the bill.
Thank
I would defer
Senator
to Senator Coe. Landon.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the good senator from Park County. I bring to you with great excitement this Teen Driver Responsibility Initiative. You may have heard a little bit about it. This is a bill that was born out of some conversations with our education professionals up in the central part of the state, and it became fairly clear to me that we needed to do all that we could to help our education professionals in dealing with the truancy problem in our schools. What this bill does, it provides two things for our young high school students. One is responsibility and the other is consequences. Like a lot of other states, we are dealing with a truancy problem, with a completion problem. The No Child Left Behind Act has asked that the state of Wyoming, like other states, get to an 80% completion rate. We have at times reached that benchmark, and at other times we have not. What this bill is just another arrow in the quiver. It gives us one more way of dealing with the problem of dropouts. That said, I can come back to a couple of other comments, but I'll walk you quickly through the bill. It's a relatively straightforward bill. It is an act requiring specified persons to show proof of school or other enrollment or having been graduated before we will give them their first driver's license. If you notice on line 9, page 1, the sections that this particular bill would affect, WS 317108A and 317111B. 317108 at the bottom is the statute dealing with those who are not to be licensed. And you will notice as you turn over to page 2 that lines 1 through 11 are existing language already in place. Those are the stipulations that this body a couple of years ago placed on the intermediate licenses as well as those driver's permits at the 15 years of age. If you go down to line 11, that's where we would add the new language. Regardless of any other qualification to receive a license except persons holding a restricted license under WS 317117C, that's hardship licenses, no person, and I would call your attention to the fact that that is where the standing committee amendment will take effect, shall receive a Class 1 or 1-2 license pursuant to 317110, or unless such person presents at the time of application the following. In other words, this is what we're going to be asking our 15-year-olds to come up with when they go in to get their learner's permit: a diploma or other certificate of high school graduation or a general education development certificate. If you move over to page 3, double little I, certification signed by the appropriate authority in a form adopted by the Department of Transportation certifying that a person is A, enrolled in a course leading to a general education development certificate, B, enrolled in a school of this state or another state, or C, enrolled in a private school as defined by WS 214101. 214101 does, in fact, include our homeschool students. Moving on down, application for license or permit generally. You'll see a slight change to reflect what we just talked about up above. The rest of the bill pretty much speaks for itself. This would be a pretty good time, I think, Mr. Chairman, to move the Committee of the Whole amendment.
So that is a standing committee amendment. I guess go ahead, Senator Landon, and move the standing committee amendment. Could the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate File 91, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 13.
Senator Coe.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment. It's been read in. Mr. Chairman, we go in on page 2 and insert some language in there that better clarifies, I think, what happens there, so that the language would say, no person who is 15 or 16 years of age shall receive a Class I or I-2 driver's license pursuant to Wyoming Statute 317110A. All this language does is really clarify it more and define the 15 and 16 years of age category for the beginner's permit or the instructional permit and actually getting a license. That's all it does. I'd ask for the support of the amendment.
You've heard the amendment. Any discussion? Question been called for. Questions on Senator Coe's motion of a due pass on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 91. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. That has passed. Committee of the Whole, we are back on the bill. Any further discussion? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
couple of final comments with regard to this bill. This is a new concept. I would say that it has been tried in many, many other states to a great deal of success. That is not why I brought this bill, not because other states are doing it. The reason I brought the bill is that this past year we lost 1,382 students to dropout. If there is an opportunity for us to salvage even 50% of those students, if you could stop and think about what kind of reimbursement that would be to those local school districts, for example, I think that if we can keep these students through the freshman and sophomore years, I think we've got a real chance. Now, I said before that this is not the golden bullet. If it were the golden bullet, the state senate would have fired that gun a long time ago. This is a very difficult problem. What this bill attempts to do is to put one more tool in the box for our education professionals. It gives our students a responsibility. It also gives them a consequence. It does not keep them from dropping out of school. If they want to drop out of school, they can certainly do that. It just means, however, that mom is going to have to drive them to work. I think it's got a chance to help. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Senator Ross.
Question for the sponsor, Mr. Chairman, and that is how, what does this do about when you have to reapply or re-up your license at a later date? A lot of times you don't have to do anything other than send in a sheet. Does this have anything to do with those situations where we all have to do that? And then my second question is, does this bill, if you did drop out and then you had to reapply later on for a driver's license, you did drop out for whatever reason, you will always be precluded from getting a driver's license unless you get a GED or something of that nature? Is that true?
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the good senator from Laramie County, good questions, and I'll try to answer both of them. I hope I remember them correctly. I believe that the standing committee amendment did help us on the one issue, Senator, which was to limit that to 15 and 16-year-olds. And as you know, in the state of Wyoming, we allow our high school students to drop out of high school at the age of 16. So this bill really is very narrow in scope for that reason. It doesn't have any effect or does not include 17 and 18-year-olds. Because from a constitutional standpoint, we simply don't have any power over a 17-year-old if they want to drop out of school. So I think at the age of 17, I think you can go into YDOT and pick up your license.
Senator Vasey?
Reluctantly in opposition to this, and I appreciate the good senator's attempt to cure the dropout rate. But until adults start being adults and start dealing with their children, all of our children, we're not going to do this. And, you know, this is not a new idea. One of the reasons they changed the carpet in the other body was myself and a prominent United States senator now brought this same bill 20 years ago, and we left little flecks of flesh and blood all over that. But that's not the point. The point is that we keep saying that, and the education community asked you to do their job to make sure kids stay in school. And until people start telling their kids to stay in school, we're not going to solve the dropout rate. And we're not going to solve it by taking their licenses because they don't care, because they're 16 years old. And you know, these feeble little attempts in a school district I won't name, but it happened to appear in the Rollins paper, they asked the principal where all these dropouts went, and he said he didn't know. Now, when there was a lot of sheep in Carbon County, that would have got a mediocre sheep herder fired. Somebody needs to know where their flock is. So, I hope this passes. I hope it works and we don't. But until the Department of Education, until these high-power superintendents and principals get off their duff and do something about it, we're going to have this dropout rate.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, if they're going to do something about it, they need to have adequate tools, and this is one more tool in the toolbox.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, there's lots of reasons that kids become dropouts, particularly in the state of Wyoming. If you're an illegal alien and get deported, you're a dropout automatically. Now, I don't know how many of you have been out in the oil field and in the ranches, but the numbers of illegal aliens that have gone back and they take their kids with them, every single one of those kids is classified as a dropout. And he's part of all these statistics that these high-powered superintendents throw at you. They're illegal aliens that went home because the economy nosedived, because the INS is looking for them. It had nothing to do with, by and large, my experience in my hometown is the immigrants love that education. But when it's time to get out of Wyoming or get out of the United States, they leave. By definition, they're a dropout because they don't show up enrolled in any other school. Federal definition. These are the dropout figures you're looking at. And I'm a dumb old rancher, but if I can tear them apart, somebody who's a professional educator ought to be embarrassed to put them out, including whatever the county is that they use the specifics on, and my counties are no better. Second thing is, there are all sorts of reasons why kids drop out of school. And to say you're going to deny them a license, quite frankly, and maybe it's a little bit of where I live, they often drop out to go to work. And they don't drop out to go to work because it's fun to go scrub out tanks in the oil field. That isn't fun. That's hard work. But they do it because it's a matter of necessity. They don't drop out to go backfill on a pipeline or build fence. That's hard, brutal work. And quite frankly, most of them are too young to be doing it full time. They drop out because their family situation makes it necessary to do it. That notwithstanding, to say we're going to deny you a driver's license with no exceptions other than school was such a failure to them or the financial necessity forced them to do it, I think is bad legislation. If you want to go in and improve the quality of the schools, improve the engagement of kids in school, and if you want to go in and help those families that are really stretched to make ends meet, or one of them gets hurt or dies or just disappears, do that. But to hammer these kids because they're a dropout, I think is wrong. Hammer the superintendent if you want. Hammer the principal. Hammer the teacher. Or go hammer their parents if you want. Because it looks to me like you're missing the two critical ingredients to education. Involve parents and good teachers. You're going to hammer the kids. My question, Mr. Chairman, now that I've ranted and raved, did you look at anything along the line of asking the parents whether they, if they sign a, whatever it is parents sign, because in fact parents are accountable for their kids, and put that as one of the qualifications in here. If the parents will sign off on the child getting a license, let the parents retain responsibility for their child. Did you look at anything along those lines? Or were the, did you look at anything along those lines in this legislation?
Senator Landon.
Chairman, I appreciate the comments from Senator from Johnson County, and the answer is yes. I did look at that. We did look at it. It's. I do want to emphasize that this bill in no way takes away the opportunity of a young man or woman receiving a hardship license. I mean, that's still in place. They still have the opportunity to do that. I would certainly be willing to talk about language that we can insert if this is a bill that you feel like needs to go forward or maybe has a chance. Hey, we can talk about some language that would include a parent signing off. In fact, you know, that's one of the good things about this measure is I've had people come to me and say, well, it's really about the parents, isn't it? Well, that's exactly what this bill is going to do. I would think that would force some conversation at home. You know, before a 15-year-old comes home for good, I would think that he or she might want to talk to mom or dad. And if they face the prospect of maybe not being able to get a driver's license, I would think that mom or dad would probably sit them down for a visit. So I am very sensitive to what the senator from Johnson County pointed out.
Senator Geis.
Against the bill. Those kids are going to drive whether you got a license or not. And a lot of them are dropping out, and you say, well, the parents sign off. The reason the kids are leaving and dropping out of school is because the home isn't any good, and he's wanting to get out, and he's going to get on his own, or she's going to get on her own. So this is just another penalty that we're trying to use another tool, but it's not going to keep the kids in school. They're going to, if they don't want to stay in school, they're not going to stay in school. And back when I was in high school, I could have been a dropper out real easy, but I guess I had the right kind of a smile or what, because my senior year I missed a lot of school because that was the Korean War, and they still gave me a diploma, and they didn't figure out probably going on to college anyway, which I didn't. But, you know, this isn't going to stop it.
Senator Perkins? Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. First of all, is there anything, in reading the bill, I didn't see anything that would prevent someone from getting their license, turning 16, going down with mom and dad, getting their license, and then having their grades, and the next day they could drop out and they would have their license, and I don't know that we could do anything about that. Maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud so I'd give anybody an idea. So that's one question. The other question is I remember a court case a number of years ago, and a fellow was trying to get in a certain piece of evidence, and he kept objecting, and the judge kept sustaining it. Finally, the judge got so frustrated, he said, if you can't come through the front door, I'm certainly not going to let you through the back door. And the reason I bring that story up is just a couple of years ago, we had a bill in this body, to make a mandatory education through age 18. And it seems to me that, can you explain to me how this is not coming to do indirectly what we refused to do directly a couple of years ago?
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the senator from Detroit County, as a matter of fact, there is an amendment here with regard to language that would take care of the problem that you pointed out, which is going down on your 15th birthday and getting your learner's permit and then the very next day dropping out of class. I apologize that amendment was not ready. This bill came up very, very quickly today, and it would be there for second reading if we send it that far. As far as the back door is concerned, I certainly fully intended to come through the front door with this particular piece of legislation. I was actually approached by a resource officer with this issue, and from the very word go, I was intrigued because I really felt like it was something to add to the quiver of arrows. I mean, there's no question, fellow senators, that we've got a lot of work to do to keep our students in school. There's no question about that. I think we all value education, and we know what that does for our young people. And being an educator myself, I understand and really value the idea of keeping them in school. Well, this is a straightforward approach. I don't think that provisions that the senator from Natrona County pointed to, which is to up the age to 18, that's not worked. And it probably is never going to work. But I think this is an opportunity for us to add a little bit of consequence to what's going on out there.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, and I do applaud Senator Landon. We all search for ways to solve this problem. And there are some kids that I'd like to take this bill when it was passed and completed and whack them over the head with it and say, this, see what we're going to do to you? You get to school. But there's too many situations that are not cut and dry. There's too many sad kids. There's too many other things than to just make this a blanket policy. And I would support anything that would keep a kid in school. But I can't do that to the detriment of the kids that I've seen and know that don't have any choices. I cannot support this bill, and I can't ever remember another education bill that I voted against that would in any way do anything for education. But thank you.
One thing about this bill that I think we miss when it's presented to us is we have a lot of bills and a lot of different ways to fix the dropout rate and keep the kids in school. And I think generally most of those bills come to us from the viewpoint of the educator, of the teacher actually in the classroom and the principals and the superintendent. What's different about this bill, that this is coming from the enforcer up in Natrona County. And I can tell you that the man's heart is in it, and he tries to figure out ways. And this was a lot stronger approach than what you see here today. I mean, there was a lot of things that were weeded out in what he wanted to do, but eventually was convinced that he couldn't do. And as my colleague from Natrona County points out, this isn't the solution for all of it. With a couple of exceptions that could be put in, as the senator from Johnson County said, I think that maybe this could be cleaned up on the next reading. We got a couple more tries at it. And if we could get the exceptions in there to cover the things that have come up, it might be that one extra tool that keeps that one other kid in school, and the rest of them can go out there and scrub tanks and oil patch. I've done it. The senator back there is right. It's not fun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief, but I just wanted to mention that I've been somewhat disappointed with some of the comments I've heard, primarily because we've been talking about dropouts. We've been talking about keeping kids in school, and it seems to me that we're missing the point. We can keep the kids in school. We can have 100% attendance, but if they're not learning, what have we achieved? And I think that's the main issue we have to look at, and I'm not sure how we go about doing that, but I think just keeping the kids in school sometimes kind of detracts from the learning aspects. And somewhere along the line, we focus so much on keeping kids in school, but not focusing enough on the teaching aspects. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right. Okay, we'll try it one more time. Okay, the question is on Senator Coe's motion. The Committee of the Whole Rise and Report, we do so in a do pass motion on Senate File 91. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no?
No.
Senate File 91 is passed, Committee of the Whole. Division being called for. All those in favor, please stand. Opposed? Okay, with the reading, would the chief clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
No.
Beep out? Excused. Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
Aye.
DeCaria?
No.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Esquivel?
No.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
No.
Honeycutt?
Yes.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson? Martin?
No.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
No.
Townsend?
No.
Townsend?
Aye.
Basie?
No.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Hines? Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 12 ayes, 16 noes, 2 excused.
Senate file 91, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate file 82. Would the reading clerk please read in the bill?
Senate file number 82, sponsored by Senator Cooper, Weed and Pest Districts Bidding, an act relating to weed and pest districts.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a due pass recommendation for Senate file 82, Weed and Pest Districts Bidding, and for an explanation of this good little bill, I yield to Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fellow Senators, Senate File 82, Weed and Pest Districts Bidding, is a bill that came about as a result of a request from our local county Weed and Pest Board. And the purpose of the bill is to increase the bid requirements that are now in the statutes from $1,500 to $10,000. As you'll see there, if you look in the bill on page 1, lines 14 and 15 of the bill, that's the only changes that are being made to the statute. I did have the LSO do research on this and find out that the $1,500 amount has been in place since 1979, which is about 30 years ago now. And as we all know, over a period of time, you know, inflation just kind of eats away at our purchasing power, and that's the same thing has happened to these districts. And so it's kind of hard for them to hardly buy anything at all for $1,500 without going through this kind of expensive and lengthy process of bidding everything out. The districts just need to have a little bit more latitude, folks, latitude. To be able to operate more efficiently, and so with that explanation, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to wrap it up, and I'll stand for questions.
Any discussion on the bill? Seeing no discussion, question been called for. The question is on Senator Schiffer's motion, and the committee of the whole rise and report it. Do so if it do pass motion on Senate File 82. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senate File 82 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried.
Reading report, read the committee the whole report. The reading clerk will.
Appropriation bills on general file begs leave to report as follows. Senate file 19, do pass amended. Senate file 86, do pass amended. Senate file 74, do pass. Senate file 85, do pass. Senate file 90, do pass amended. Senate file 91, failed to pass the committee of the whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate file 82, do pass. Senator Meyer, chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. President, I move the adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You're getting good. You've heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passed. Reports from standing committee.
January the 20th, 2009, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred Senate File 53, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Larson, Martin, Perkins, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 20th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 13, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Jennings, Session, Burns, and Co., Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Von Platen.
Mr. President, Senate File 38, Real ID Compliance, was read in just before lunch, and it does have small appropriations, and I ask that it be re-referred to appropriations.
Senate File 38 is re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, without objections. Senator Escobel.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Senate File 66 was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, and there is a fiscal impact on that, as could be referred to committee number 2.
Senate File 66 will be referred to committee number 2, Appropriations, without objections. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate be adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Okay, announcement. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the committee room. Senate File 106, Medication Disposal Program. Senate File 24, Healthcare Reform Demonstration Project. Senate File 43, Healthcare Access Project Design. There, I would inform the committee and the public that we do hope to be, we'll take public testimony on Senate Files 24 and 43. We do hope to be able to work them, or at least in part, and there are some amendments available to both the committee members and the public on Senate File 24 available in the committee room, should be available right now.
Senator Von Platen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Number 8, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, giving notice that we are not meeting on Wednesday at adjournment due to scheduled events that evening, but we'll take up the following bills on Friday at noon, 15 minutes after noon recess: Senate File 60, National Guard Youth Challenge Program; Senate File 63, text messages while driving prohibited; Senate File 65, cellular phone use prohibited while driving; and Senate File 98, fines for speeding trucks. Thank you.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Joint Appropriations Committee is going to meet immediately right now to on callbacks for the Department of Transportation, as well as the Judiciary. That's as soon as I announce this, we ought to head off and do that. The Senate Appropriations Committee will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. to consider the following re-referred bills: Senate File 5, State Parks and Cultural Resources, South Pass City; Senate File 37, Antifreeze and Petroleum Products; Senate File 42, Select Committee on Local Government Financing; Senate File 58, Vehicle Title Registration. The Joint Appropriations Committee will also meet on Thursday at 2 p.m. or immediately following the adjournment. Actually, I think it's now. It's immediately following the adjournment, but not later than 3:30, to hear callbacks from the Department of Ag and the Water Development Commission. And we'll be meeting again on Friday morning at 7:30 to hear callbacks from the University of Wyoming, the Treasurer's Office, and the Department of Administration and Information.
Mr. Vice President, Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Excuse me. Your committee number one, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to hear the following bills: Senate File 41, Debt Collection, Statute of Limitations; Senate File 97, Unborn Victims of Violence Act; and Senate File 84, Aggravated Assault, Choking.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number seven, Corporations, Elections, Political Subdivisions, continues its saga of the new corporations law. We'll meet an S-19 upon adjournment today. Hopefully we'll be able to get in a meeting upon adjournment tomorrow, and then we'll be meeting early Thursday morning, 7 o'clock, S-19.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number nine, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow at 30 minutes after the noon recess in S-18 to consider Senate File 51, Title Insurance.
Senator Vasey.
Mr. President, your committee number five, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet in about 10 minutes in S-15 to discuss Senate File 34, Beginning Agriculture Producer Finance Authority; Senate File 69, Fertilizers; Senate File 32, Wyoming Livestock Health and Emergency Disease Program; Senate File 36, Intentional Feeding of Elk; and Senate File 8, Feral Livestock.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, if I heard correctly a few minutes ago, there was a request to re-refer Senate File 66 to the Appropriations Committee. Mr. President, if that's correct, my information is that bill is the Medicaid foot care bill, and that it was assigned to Committee 10, and it's still there. We have not heard it. If that's the circumstance, I would most strongly object to that re-referral.
Perhaps we have the wrong bill number, Senator. Senator Esquivel.
Mr. President, no, Senator Scott is correct. I jumped the gun a little bit. Sorry.
You didn't have a bill to re-refer or another number?
No, I was just mistaken in terms of the process.
Okay.
I apologize.
Okay, the correction is made, Senator. Senate File 66 have not been re-referred. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I've just been informed that our Minerals Committee, your Committee Number 9, Minerals Committee, Business Economic Development, will meet actually tomorrow at exactly noon recess.
Majority Floor Leader,
Thank you, Mr. President. Before we take final action on adjournment, I just want to compliment all the senators in regard to the work that you've been getting done in Committee of the Whole, the quality of your debate, the quality of your questions. I think you're doing well. Also, I would like to serve warning that when your bill comes out of committee and is read in on the floor, be ready to hit the ground running. If there's no appropriation, it's apt to go up quickly. So get your research done, get your amendments in line, and we're going to just keep right on moving. But terrific job, and we hope that we can hold this pace as we go through the session. Thank you, Mr. President.
The motion on the floor is the Senate will stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Senate is adjourned until 10 a.m.